Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners. I hope all of you are doing well, and no matter where you live in the world, I hope all of you are having a good weekend. Hard to believe, tomorrow will mark the first full week to the month of March, and hard to believe that not too terribly far down the road this month, it'll be St. Patrick's Day. But then again, it definitely feels like March, to say the least. You know, what I find hard to believe as well, it's not so much that we're in the month of March, but today's date it's one of those dates, I think, that either some people remember, if they are big history buffs like me, but for those of you who have forgotten about the importance of this date, that's okay. I won't hold you responsible, but it ought to be an important reminder. 253 years ago today, an event took place in America. An event that just wasn't one of those one-night events, but it was an event that happened where the loss of life and how it happened had not come upon American soil up until the time that it occurred. In other words, wouldn't it be fair to say that when multiple people died in one setting on a particular day or night, 253 some years ago, would it be fair to say that because of multiple people passing away on a particular day, it was due to a disease outbreak? Sure. Is it fair to say that death by violence was unheard of 253 years ago? Absolutely. But sadly, the event I am referring to that happened 253 years ago was part of a broader movement. That event being the Boston Massacre. Now, I must point something out. When I first began podcasting back in June of 2020, and I know many of you have been with me since that time in terms of following the topics that I have discussed, rather book topic series that I've discussed, it is hard to believe that when I first began podcasting back in June of 2020, the first book that I did was titled John Adams, The Boston Massacre Trials, written by Dan Abrams. And I'm sure many of you are now thinking to yourself, Kirk, are you going to do another podcast on the Boston Massacre, given that you have just brought up the remembrance date of what had happened 253 years ago? Normally, I would tell you all the titles at the very end of what it is that we're going to be doing with regards to a new upcoming book topic series. I still plan on doing that, but what I will tell you all right now is that we will be revisiting the Boston Massacre. I'm sure some of you are wondering, well, when you shared this topic, Kirk, nearly 3 years ago, didn't we cover everything there was about it? Some of you could say yes, and perhaps you are entitled to your own opinion on it. But not too long ago, I read another book about the Boston Massacre. And there were things about this, the book that was written regarding the massacre incident. There was a whole host of new information that I did not know existed. In other words, just when I thought I had learned everything there was about the Boston Massacre, it turns out, upon reading this book, there were other elements or factors that I just did not take into consideration. Yes, there was lots of information I learned that I was able to present to you all when doing the book on Dan Abrams being John Adams under fire with the Boston Massacre trials. Sure, there was another book I had written or I'd read before the pandemic on the Boston Massacre. It was actually the first one, Eric Hinderaker's Boston's Massacre, which was very well written. But the reason I feel, one of the reasons I feel it's important to revisit the Boston Massacre is not so much because of what happened on the night of March 5th, 1770. It's not so much what happened on that night, but what, and not so much what led up to the incident, but really in a sense how people coexisted with one another. If I give it away now, or give away more information now, there may not even be a need for a formal introduction. But the reason I'm telling you all this now is so that you don't get caught off guard, or don't think to yourselves, well, you know, Kirk, you just did a series about nearly 3 years ago. Why are we doing another one? Well, I think it's time for us to get started with the introduction to where we're going. But before I get started, I am going to mention an important individual's name, a man from Massachusetts. But I also should point out that this individual will not be our primary focal person to talk about in the series, but his presence and what he did is important because even his work alone tells a story. And, you know, whenever someone does a piece of work, even if it's a piece of artistic work, that also, it's not, oh, here's a portrait of someone or here's a picture of people. It has to tell a story. It has to tell a story of what is going on at that exact moment in time. So let's find out about who this individual is and how it all, and how his works do tie into what happened, not only so much after March 5th, of not only what happened on March 5th, 1770, but where things went after March 5th of 1770, because, you know, there again, you know, we think, oh, one, you know, an incident happens on one night and that's just the end of it. No, that's really not how it works. So here we go with an introduction to where we're going next in our new podcast book topic series. And at the very end, I will give you all the formal title. Of course, I know many of you all are already saying, yes, it's going to be about the Boston Massacre, but the title piece also is probably what's far more important, because that will help explain why we are revisiting this. So here we go. Paul Revere was a man whose achievements during the American Revolutionary Movement can best be summarized as instrumental. Okay? You know, Paul Revere, yes, he was a man of various trades, and he, we should be reminded that he did more than just say the British were coming come April of 1775. While many individuals tend to associate America's revolutionary movement from a battlefield campaign perspective, the events which surfaced prior to April 19, 1775 sometimes get overlooked. The year 1770, or rather I should say, the year of 1770 start up north in Boston, Massachusetts, wasn't considered anything 100% peaceful. March 1770 saw Paul Revere hard at work in his Boston workshop, where he spent relentless moments reflecting upon what had happened within the town over a three-week course. Okay, folks, over a three-week course. It's not so much what happened on just one particular night, but what has happened within a three-week course. Given Revere's connections to the Sons of Liberty organization, he would go about learning an abundance of information behind what took place on the evening of March 5, 1770, along King Street, as five individuals died, eight British soldiers, or I should say roughly eight British soldiers, detained in the town's jail. Now it was time for Paul Revere himself, after obtaining an abundance of information behind what had taken place on March 5th, he felt it was now time to address a greater story. Paul Revere's primary occupation was that of silversmith. In the midst of what had transpired from mid-February to early March 1770, Paul Revere was engaged in serious work. Well, I can tell you this much, it was more than just doing silversmith work, folks. The work that he really was focused upon was through sheets of copper depicting the evening of March 5th. However, Paul Revere was not alone in competition for trying to sell a story behind what unraveled through sketch drawings. There is a fellow by the name of Henry Pelham. I'll say it right now, and I will say it again before the introduction comes to an end, or prologue, I should say. Henry Pelham has become one of those individuals who has been forgotten. Well, anyways, Henry Pelham is an acquaintance of Paul Revere's. Never hurts to be acquaintance with someone who's as skilled of a silversmith like Paul Revere. So Henry Pelham is an acquaintance of Paul Revere's. Just so happens that Mr. Pelham had already composed a handful of sketches in regards to the shooting, which included an infamous perfect line. Another word for infamous, we could say, is like well-known or something that's just not forgotten. So you have this infamous perfect line where British soldiers, including their commanding officer with his sword rising above, go about attacking the crowd, pouring on merciless fire. In other words, merciless rounds of ammunition being fired, or in the case by 1770 terminology, merciless lead bullets, we should say, being fired into the crowd. While having agreed to keep Pelham's delicate line of soldiers, including the lead officer, intact, Paul Revere sought out an extra additional element regarding the story's headline, which he believed was fundamental behind promoting what occurred March 5, 1770. Revere was dabbling with multiple title proposal names. One such idea for a title name was Butcher's Hall, in reference to the custom house that was on King Street, where the British soldiers had been lodged. They came out from, of course, I don't know if I should give it all away, but one soldier had been pelted with various objects, from oyster shells to snowballs or a block of ice. And after being pelted, he went to the customs house to get reinforcement. So when you hear custom house and hearing Butcher's Hall, for Paul Revere, it's not the customs house. He'd rather think of it as Butcher's Hall. Another proposal Paul Revere had was referring to William Hogarth's work known as Gin Lane, which comprised of run-down, dilapidated buildings, to people along the streets succumbing to alcohol's evils. Never hurts to have a couple of different proposal titles when you're trying to work on a masterpiece that you are... Well, I don't know if Revere would have even thought of it as a masterpiece at that moment, but trying to work on something that will tell not just the people of Massachusetts a unique story, but perhaps the rest of colonial America as to what really happened. Quite often, people tend to associate works of art through mediums like, you know, portraits, where paintings depict a person, group of people, to an important event where matter at stake has power behind altering history's course for better or for worse. Well, there's nothing wrong with paintings. I mean, they are powerful. However, Paul Revere's platform is different. As I mentioned earlier, he was taking to the use of doing work involving copper sheets. So copper sheets, folks, don't include paintbrushes. But instead, Paul Revere is relying upon using a burin, or a burin, spelled B-U-R-I-N. I didn't even know what a burin was until I had, started learning more about Paul Revere from various perspectives, including his artistical work when doing unique designs involving silversmith and also through means of using copper sheets. So this burin is a device, or what we would call a steel tool, for engraving in copper or wood. So in other words, it's like a chisel. It would be fair to say shortly after what had transpired between mid-February into the start of March 1770 that Revere's burin underwent multiple trials behind getting to the roots within a town embroiled by conflict where violence had superseded tranquility over a three-week course. That's not to say that there had been some violence that had occurred, or lower levels of violence, I should say, that occurred before the start of 1770. But we will be learning in this new podcast book topic series that you know, whatever we were taught before in the past about the night, about March 5th, 1770, not all the bad stuff happened on one night. And perhaps maybe not everything was as 100% bad as what we were led to believe from old textbooks from years past. Going forward, Revere chose to include the sign on the Custom House building dubbed Butcher's Hall. Revere intended those to see his work as depicting a scene where hungry-driven British troops, acting upon their lead commanding officer's orders, fired into a crowd, but at the same time, another group had helped contribute to the existing situation. This other group, in Paul Revere's mind, was better known by their formal title as tax collectors, customs officials, whose presence had been frowned upon by Boston's masses, given collectors tended to be portrayed as individuals whose concerns centered upon catering to a few people versus listening to the needs of the many. Perhaps the masses felt that the tax collectors were reaping in the greater profits and were reaping in the rewards, knowing that the real rewards should have been perhaps diverted back to the people, whom to the greater public or the greater society of Boston. So anyways, as I said a moment ago, many people had frowned upon Boston's upon the tax collectors and customs officials, given that they had often viewed these individuals whose ideals had centered upon catering to a few versus the needs of the many. Paul Revere wanted the greater public to see his eventual masterpiece as one where British troops and politicians were to be held responsible behind what unraveled the evening of March 5th, 1770, not the civilians whom got innocently mowed down. As ardent a patriot Paul Revere was, his work alone couldn't convince everyone going forward that what he embarked upon would ultimately seal the fate behind those accused, being the British soldiers. I'm beginning to wonder if Paul Revere's work, as great as his work will turn out to be, I'm beginning to wonder if it would also be one of those pieces of work where it actually tells not just one side of the story, but perhaps two sides of the story But then again, it could perhaps tell multiple sides of the story where it goes beyond the famous two sides to each story. Paul Revere continued taking an interest in Henry Pelham's picture, drawing most notably, knowing how nothing was left behind in the center, where the heart of the matter, or I should say the issue, lied at stake. If you look very carefully at this unique piece of work, and most of us, when we first learned about it, in our lifetimes, probably saw it in a textbook, a school textbook, I should say. That's where, believe it or not, I myself even first saw this famous picture. If one looks carefully at the picture, high above on the far left-hand side, there's a crescent moon high above. You know, I mentioned how there were events that occurred on the night of March 5th, 1770. Well, of course, that should tell us right away that it happened in the evening. Dark when it's nighttime, a moon is outside. But it's also easy to mistake the presence of a moon, because when you look at the picture, it's also easy to think that it was happening in broad daylight just because of how it presents itself. Also on the far left side, one can see smoke coming out from a chimney, which should be a reminder that people inside still needed to heat their homes as winter's grip had not let up. Revere was moved by these features, but another, which he kept, pertained to an abundance of church steeples, signifying Boston's presence as a town, home to ardent churchgoers, representing broad religious faith spectrums. Pelham's picture showed a woman in the crowd, but Revere wanted her to be visible, meaning that she and every other townsperson present on King Street weren't considered rowdy, or I should say rough people, but instead decent folks, maybe what we might think of today as average middle-class people. Revere, though, decided to place this woman facing behind British soldiers as a means of protecting her identity. Perhaps Paul Revere chose this because if he had the woman looking at the soldiers, would the soldiers have thought twice before firing? In other words, would the woman herself have tried to have engaged in gestures with her hands, saying, please don't fire upon these people, only for some in the crowd on the opposite side, being the protesters, to wonder, is this woman, what else does this woman know that perhaps we don't know? Is she trying to make peace with the soldiers? Because I can tell you this much, there were protesters who, as that phrase that we know today, you know, egging it on. I will admit right now to you all, there were protesters on the night of March 5th, 1770, who were egging it on to where they were daring the soldiers to fire at them. So think about that. So, yes, Revere chose to place this woman facing behind British soldiers as a means of protecting her identity. Whereas Henry Pelham's version did not make things simpler for counting the exact number of soldiers involved, Paul Revere made out two soldiers hidden by smoke, which proved, according to Revere, that there were seven enemy soldiers firing upon the crowd. Revere knew how vital the gun smoke proved, given a solid white line in the center separated civilized soldiers wearing formal fighting clothing attire from an opposing side where a crowd of townspeople got shot down. The section of smoke not only paved a dividing line amongst Boston's townspeople and the soldiers involved on March 5th, but the large column of smoke was meant to magnify versus hiding what some could dismiss as being circumstantial testimony. So in other words, a large column of smoke would mean that all soldiers were firing at the same time. It could lead some to say, yes, the commanding officer instructed his soldiers to fire upon us. We shall wait and see. Henry Pelham's original title, The Fruits of Arbitrary Power or the Bloody Massacre, in the eyes of Paul Revere was too long. Revere instead modified Pelham's title with the following engraved wording, The Bloody Massacre, which entailed the violence, the focal center point, to those people guilty. Those people guilty, in Paul Revere's eyes, ought to be the British troops, given they fired into the crowd. Paul Revere spent 3 weeks creating a masterpiece through relying upon copper sheeting and a burin for engraving. What would become a story ingrained in the hearts of generations going forward? However, Paul Revere's achievement, folks, came at the expense of Henry Pelham. I'm sure some of you are beginning to wonder, how does Paul Revere know everything that Henry Pelham has done? Well, it just so happens, folks, that Henry Pelham lent Mr. Revere a copy of The Fruits of Arbitrary Power. Little did Pelham realize that Revere went a step further by copying the original work to producing his own personal engraving. Henry Pelham lent a copy of his work to Paul Revere, but little did he know that Revere's work would triumph, resulting in his being taken advantage of. Had Pelham not lent a copy of The Fruits of Arbitration to Paul Revere, one can only imagine what recognition and fame might have been bestowed upon the other fella whose name and story got discredited. You know, it's one thing to have lent somebody something, even back then. You would, as much as one would like to believe that if I lent someone a copy of the work I had done, especially with regards to what happened on the night of March 5th, 1770, I would expect that the individual, you know, would have the decency to return it back to me. But I also would have assumed that, okay, if I've lent a copy to Paul Revere of the work I've done, I would assume that he would not go behind my back, or I should say stab me in the back, and come up with his own creation. Some could say that perhaps Paul Revere plagiarized someone else's piece of work. Maybe he did. But at the same time, there were no copyright laws back then. There were no such things as patent laws. We have to keep in mind, folks, this was not a competition or a prize competition to see who could come up with the best piece of work. So, is it fair to say that we could have some sympathy for Mr. Pelham? Yes. But it also should go to show that no matter how well you know someone, sometimes you can't always trust the other person 100%. It really is fair to say that had Henry Pelham not lent a copy of The Fruits of Arbitration to Paul Revere, as I said earlier, that yes, who knows what recognition and fame might have gotten bestowed upon Mr. Pelham. In other words, is it fair to say that the textbooks would have had the famous picture titled as The Fruits of Arbitration? Perhaps. At the same time, is it fair to say that Paul Revere still would have tried to come up with a great piece of work? Sure. But just keep in mind, Paul Revere would have come in second place had Henry Pelham not lent him his picture or his work, The Arts of or The Fruits of Arbitration. Paul Revere's copper sheet engraving is more than just depicting an infamous event where multiple people died by circumstances never seen or prior to March 5, 1770. Prior to becoming America's first vice president and second president, John Adams in 1770 was a lawyer, but chose to take a stand, doing something beyond the norm that most people, even after the massacre had occurred, would never have even thought of wanting to do. But John Adams was open-minded. As a lawyer, you know, one would have to be open-minded. But even in 1770, John Adams knew that he had to do something different. Nobody asked him to do this. There were other individuals, believe it or not, who were offered to defend the accused, being those British soldiers who fired into the crowd. Those other individuals turned it down. I'm sure they probably turned it, one of the primary reasons for turning it down, the offer down, was due to the fact that they might have gotten shamed in their communities for having done so. Not John Adams. John Adams went above and beyond the norm by defending the accused soldiers in court. And there were a couple of reasons. Number one, John Adams felt that the accused had a right to appear in a courtroom of law. He also believed that they had the right to be tried by a jury of their peers. John Adams also believed that the accused had the right to a fair trial. In other words, yes, they may be accused of doing something, but they do need to have their side of the story presented in a courtroom of law. I think it's fair to say that John Adams, I probably might even mention this again somewhere in this story, because it will come up in the very end of the podcast topic series, how John Adams goes about defending the soldiers in the courtroom. And I will tell you right now that there were some other things that I learned when having read this book that that I just did not come into contact with when having read John Adams Under Fire, The Boston Massacre Trials. So I will make sure that I don't repeat myself based upon what we talked about from that first podcast book topic series almost 3 years ago. So anyways, John Adams... yes, he goes about defending the accused soldiers in court. He took Paul Revere's engraving by conveying a different story, where Boston's townspeople, folks, were labeled as the perpetrators. In other words, the instigators, the ones who egged it on by hurling objects at the British soldiers. And if the if Boston's townspeople, in Adams' eyes, were the perpetrators, then the British soldiers were the victims. Although each man, Paul Revere and John Adams, made a case behind what the engraving truly represented from conflict within the town's public square to gunshots being at the center of the matter, the story has never faded away, even after 253 years, given historians know more now than what the textbooks told us from generations past. So, you know, it was so easy for years to just assume that those who were shot at were protesting peacefully. They weren't hurling things at the soldiers. Matter of fact, the first time I actually came upon learning how the protesters had hurled things at the soldiers was watching the documentary TV series, John Adams, whom was played by the character, the HBO series, John Adams, who was played by the character playing John Adams was Paul Giamatti, who did a phenomenal job. But I remember seeing in the movie the protesters hurling such objects from oyster shells, snowballs, blocks of ice, and a whole other assortment of objects they could have gotten their hands on. So in other words, whatever, yes, Paul Revere's work, even though it was originally done by Henry Pelham, yes, the work shows us that it might tell us that the protesters were mowed down innocently, but we do have to keep in mind that what Paul Revere and Henry Pelham didn't want the public to know was that there were objects being thrown at the soldiers. The soldiers did get knocked down, and it just got to the point where they weren't going to take any abuse no more. The soldiers had even told the protesters that we were not going to fire on you all, but we are going to have a presence. Given that you just hurled objects at one of our soldiers by having more soldiers present, hopefully this ought to be enough of a deterrent to let you all know that you can protest, but you're going to protest peacefully, but it's going to be with nonviolence. But as we should know now, that was not the case. And when I saw the documentary, that's when I realized, well, the textbooks didn't want us to know what really had taken place. It's amazing sometimes what even a textbook can conceal in terms of not wanting us to know the real truth. So what if I told you all another story that goes beyond Paul Revere's copper sheet engraving picture in John Adams's courtroom role? It's true, considering, for one, those who made up the British Army's ranks weren't all bent on inflicting terror within Boston streets. Instead, folks, the greater British Army consisted of single men, or rather I should say bachelors, including married men with families, to rogue men dubbed as being dishonest. Whereas some soldiers, or I should say whereas some British soldiers arrived into Boston with their families intact, many other British soldiers went about making new families upon their arrival. Prior to March 5th, 1770, a good portion of Bostonians weren't entirely opposed to British rule, meaning there wasn't anything in existence regarding factions between loyalist and patriot. Despite being labeled as Britons, the dilemma prior to 1770 centered upon the best methods behind British rule in the post-Seven Years' War era, a.k.a. French and Indian War. Nearly 4 years saw stability prevail within a town whose peninsula was not greater than 1 square mile, including an isthmus being a neck, being in this case the Boston neck, where there was only one way in and one way out. So in other words, folks, there was no such thing in 1770 as the big, it was part of that project that led to the big dig with the underground tunnel. So let's keep in mind, folks, no such thing as an underground tunnel for getting traffic in and out. There's only one way in and one way out in 1770, known as the Boston neck. Too many people from generations past, including present day, often forgot that Boston wasn't as polarized as the textbooks wanted us to believe. Throughout Boston streets, soldiers and their families, along with the locals, met and interacted peacefully. Whatever levels existed regarding a true state of peace amongst Boston's people, or amongst Boston's greater peoples, was forever altered on the night of March 5th, 1770. Yes, tension did exist in regards to British soldiers' presence, but the greater relationship behind preserving what laid intact lost its relevancy. March 5th, 1770 marked the straw which broke the camel's back, resulting in shattering the town's peace only to be replaced by factions, including extremism acts. Here is the Boston Massacre, folks, told from a family historical perspective. So here is our title, our formal title, to our next book podcast topic series, The Boston Massacre, A Family History by Serena Zabin. Well, folks, I hope that you all will find this well worth learning about. And yes, for those of you who are with me and who have been with me for some time and were with me when I did my first podcast book topic about the Boston Massacre, I hope that you all will learn more about the Boston Massacre than what I was able to tell you 3 years ago. I hope that, okay, yes, I can tell you right now that what I shared with you all 3 years ago was 101. But I'm hoping that this go-around will be beyond 101. And I do believe that telling this story is important because, as I said earlier, the textbooks didn't want to tell us that there actually were peaceful times in Boston. It may not have been 100% peaceful, but people did learn to get along. And I think it's important for us to explore these relations. We need to learn what prompted British soldiers, mostly those bachelors, to want to branch out, to want to be different. We might need to realize that that only a small percentage of the British army was comprised of those who could afford commissions or who could pay for a commission, and that the vast majority were those whom were just everyday common people. Would it be fair to say that not all of, not every British soldier, or rather the British Army as a whole, is it fair to say that not everyone whom comprised of the British Army was considered to be a monster? I don't believe so. Sure, we might learn that there were British soldiers whom were bent on inflicting harm upon Boston's peoples, but we should be reminded that even amongst the British inner circle of officers, I think we should be reminded and will be reminded in this book topic series that there were British officers whose wives hailed from America, who had ties with family in America. And those ties were not, say, perhaps 100% British, although some were. So when I'm on the air again next, what we're going to be discussing is the following. We're going to learn about a lady who, she's not a famous woman, but she is a married woman. Her name is Jane Chambers. So what we're going to be talking about when I'm on the air again next is a chapter known as Families of Empire, starting in the year 1765. So we're going to learn about a family named Jane and Matthew Chambers and their journey, say 3,000 miles across the ocean to Boston. And I think we also should be reminded that that while, yes, the British Army is the largest army in the world at this time, we should also be reminded that not all British Army regiments depart from England to make their journey over to America. We should be reminded that British Army regiments in other parts of the world where their presence is needed most will be diverted to America to help keep the peace. In other words, yes, there is some conflict going on in Boston prior to 1770, but there needs to be a presence of troops. The bigger question is, it's one thing to bring troops into Boston. It's going to be another thing to see how Boston's people respond to the presence of troops. In other words, is the presence of troops going to make or break things so much so to where violence could be seen as a daily norm, day in and day out? Well, we will have to find out more as we continue to progress into our new book topic, or rather into our new podcast book topic series, The Boston Massacre, A Family History by Serena Zabin. Thank you for your time as always, and I look forward to being back on the air again with you all next time. And wherever you all may live in the world, continue to stay safe. Take care for now.